KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. The White House stops all military aid to Ukraine after the disastrous meeting between Presidents Trump and Zelensky. What could happen on the ground if Ukraine loses access to American weapons? It's Morning Edition from NPR News. The trade war is delayed no longer. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Fadel. Overnight, the Trump administration went ahead with sweeping tariffs against China, Canada, and Mexico. Retaliation, tariffs against the U.S., was swift. Also, Mexico says American gun makers are responsible for the flood of guns across the border. And novelist Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie on longing to be known. It's Tuesday, March 4th. On this day in 1918, military doctors formally identified a new flu strain in Kansas. The pandemic would infect a third of the world. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. President Trump's threatened tariffs have gone into effect overnight against Canada and Mexico. They're worth 25%. Tariffs against China have doubled and are now at 20%. Trump says this is to stop illegal immigration and drug trafficking. Canada and China have responded instantly, imposing high tariffs on some U.S. products. Mexico is acting in a more measured fashion. NPR's Ada Peralta reports Mexico's president plans to unveil retaliatory measures during a public event this weekend.
The Mexican government has given President Trump everything he has asked for. They added thousands of troops to the border, they stepped up their counter-narcotics operations, and they sent to the USA 29 of its biggest drug dealers. Statistics show migrant border crossings are at a historic low, and the flow of fentanyl to the United States has also slowed. Mexican President Claudia Sheinbaum denounced the new measures.
No hay motivo, razón.
There's no motive, reason, or justification, she said, that supports this decision, which will affect our people and nations. Allowing time for dialogue, President Sheinbaum said she would wait until Sunday to announce retaliatory measures. She called on all the Mexican people to show up at the capital city's main square for her speech. Ada Peralta, NPR News, Mexico City.
President Trump will address a joint session of Congress tonight. He's expected to press lawmakers for his priorities, including more tax cuts and increase spending on border security. NPR's Danielle Kurtz-Leben says there is an unusual dynamic hanging over his speech.
This Congress, which is narrowly controlled by Republicans, they have been remarkably acquiescent to Trump's norm-shattering moves. And that acquiescence has come even as Trump has consolidated wide-ranging governmental powers into the executive branch, including powers that Congress historically has had, things like imposing tariffs.
NPR's Danielle Kurtz-Leben reporting. The European Union Commission president has proposed an $840 billion plan to quickly build up defense budgets in Europe. As NPR's Rob Schmitz reports, the announcement came shortly after President Trump said he is pausing U.S. military aid to Ukraine.
EU Commission President Ursula von der Leyen calls the plan Rearm Europe. The five-point plan includes a relaxation of EU member state debt rules. It also includes incentives for states to increase defense spending. Von der Leyen said a new fund worth more than $150 billion would support the EU's 27 member states in investing in defense, while relaxing the EU's debt rules would free up more than $680 billion over the next 4 years. She also said member states could use funding intended for other EU programs to increase defense spending. Von der Leyen said this is Europe's moment and that, quote, we must live up to it. Rob Schmitz, NPR News, Berlin.
On Wall Street, the Dow is down more than 700 points. It's NPR. The National Science Foundation says it plans to reinstate roughly half of the staff it fired last month. NPR's Jonathan Lambert reports the move is in response to a federal court decision last week.
In February, the National Science Foundation terminated about 10% of its staff in response to President Trump's executive orders aimed at reducing the federal workforce. At NSF, roughly half of those fired were probationary employees who are typically in the first year of a new job. Last week, a federal judge ruled that the mass firings of probationary employees is illegal and should be stopped. In response, NSF says it plans to rehire, with full back pay, all 86 probationary staff they terminated. But the NSF will not be rehiring the other half of those fired, as they were temporary employees. Many scientists worry that the mass firing would slow or stall the agency's work funding basic research across the U.S. Jonathan Lambert, NPR News.
Officials in South Carolina say a wildfire near the coastal city of Myrtle Beach has grown to more than 2,000 acres. It is less than a third contained. Fire officials are warning of heavy smoke in the forest area where it is burning. New Orleans is celebrating Fat Tuesday with traditional Mardi Gras parades, costumes, dancing, and beads. But authorities have cut short some parades or canceled others entirely. Forecasters have issued warnings for damaging winds today. A powerful line of thunderstorms is sliding east this morning. They could strike New Orleans later today. Again on Wall Street, the Dow is now down 760 points. It's NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include CFP, Certified Financial Planner Professionals, committed to acting in their clients' best interests. Learn more at letsmakeaplan.org. And the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Fadel. We start with President Trump's trade war this morning. His latest round of tariffs took effect at midnight, meaning most imports from Canada and Mexico will now include a 25% levy. And tariffs on Chinese goods doubled from 10 to 20%. As soon as the announcement happened, the markets reacted, and not in a good way. China and Canada responded with retaliatory tariffs, and Mexico says it plans to do the same. So what does this mean for businesses, consumers, and confidence in the economy? To discuss this, we're joined by Mark Zandi. He's chief economist at Moody's Analytics, which provides global economy analysis. Good morning and welcome back to the program.
Good morning, Leila. Good to be with you.
Okay, so let's break down what these tariffs mean for specific industries. What will be impacted and what does that mean for prices for U.S. consumers?
Well, prices will go up if all of the tariffs go into effect and stay into effect. And those are, you know, some big ifs. But if that happens, the typical American household will have to shell out $1,200 to $1,300 more a year to buy the same goods that they're buying now. And it's lots of stuff. You know, we're buying vehicles and groceries, footwear, clothing, consumer electronics. You know, even, you know, the cost of housing is going to go up because we import a lot of lumber from Canada. We get a lot of building materials from Mexico. We get appliances from China. And so that will drive up the cost of homes and rent. So all goods prices will go up and Americans will have to pay more for that.
Now, we heard the Treasury Secretary, Scott Bessent, say this weekend that that estimate is actually alarmist, that it will go up $1,200 a year. Let's hear a bit more of what he said on CBS News Face the Nation this weekend.
We have the experience of President Trump's first term, where the tariffs did not affect prices, and it's a holistic approach that there will be tariffs, there will be cuts in regulation, there will be cheaper energy. So I would expect that very quickly we will be down to the Fed's 2% target.
What's your reaction to that?
Prices are going to go up. That's the experience from the tariffs that were imposed in President Trump's first term. A lot of good academic research showing that. And it's important to realize that the inflationary backdrop today is very different than it was back in 2018-19, the last time we went through this. 2018-19, the problem was inflation was too low, and we weren't even thinking about inflation. But this go-around, ask any American what the number one problem is, and they'll tell you it's higher prices. So we're in a whole different world than we were back then. So I think we should count on, yeah, maybe I'm wrong. It's possible, but I wouldn't count on it, and a prudent planner wouldn't either.
What do you expect these new tariffs will do to confidence in the U.S. economy?
Well, it's already hurting. This combined with a lot of other changes in economic policy that are occurring right now is creating a lot of uncertainty in the economy. And you can feel it. You can see it in business surveys. You can see it in the consumer confidence survey. A very important survey came out last week and showed a big decline. In fact, consumers are also saying that they expect higher prices from the tariffs. Inflation, so-called inflation expectations, are up. And of course, then we've seen the stock market down. And it's not surprising when you have a lot of uncertainty, when you don't. And here we've got, Layla, a boatload of uncertainty, right? I mean, tariffs on which countries, which products, over what period of time, they're on again, they're off again. Think about that from the perspective of a business person trying to decide to make an investment or a hiring decision, particularly these investment decisions that take many years, that play out over many years. You build a factory that's going to be around for decades. You need certainty. You need, some confidence in the rules of the road, and tariffs are a key rule. And if you don't have that, you're not, I don't know that you cut. I don't know that it means you fire people. I don't know that it means you cut investment. That would be recession, but I think it does mean you sit on your hands, and that's what's happening.
What is the big takeaway, though, here with this boatload of uncertainty, like you put it?
Not good. I think we need clarity around economic policy for people to make decisions, to go out and spend, and businesses to invest and hire, for investors to feel confident. So, all those things are critical to a well-functioning economy. You can feel, Layla, the economy's kind of gagging here under this uncertainty. All the economic data we've been getting over the past month or two are on the soft side of things, and maybe it overstates the case, but it's making a case. The tariffs, broad-based tariffs, are a real problem for the economy.
That is Mark Zandi, chief economist at Moody's Analytics. Thank you for your time.
Sure thing.
The White House says it will pause military aid to Ukraine as the country continues to defend itself from Russian attacks.
A White House official told NPR the administration wants to review the aid to see if it is contributing to peace. The decision comes after President Trump and Vice President Vance berated Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky in an Oval Office meeting last Friday.
Joining us now to talk about all this is NPR's Ukraine correspondent Joanna Kakissis. Joanna, good morning.
Good morning, Michelle.
Joanna, do we know what this pause will affect, what kinds of weaponry, et cetera, it will cover?
Well, Michelle, we don't know a whole lot so far. This pause appears to affect at least $1 billion in weapons and ammunition en route and on order for Ukraine. It's unclear whether this pause also includes cutting off intelligence sharing, a partnership that has helped Ukraine strategize and plan. I should emphasize that this is the worst case scenario for Ukrainians, since the U.S. has been the country's strongest single ally since Russia's full-scale invasion 3 years ago. And it's painful for Ukrainians because President Zelensky has repeatedly thanked the U.S. for helping his country, and Ukrainians say they are fighting to preserve American-style liberty and democracy.
Do you have a sense of whether this was a surprise in Ukraine?
Well, there hasn't been much official reaction yet, though a member of Ukraine's parliament said lawmakers have been in meetings to find alternatives to U.S. aid. I've been speaking with Ukrainians over the last few days, and many say they were expecting something like this. Even before Friday's debacle in the Oval Office, President Trump was repeating Kremlin talking points, for example, claiming it was Ukraine, not Russia, that started the war, and the Trump administration has not been pushing back on some of Moscow's demands, including Ukraine giving up territory and a path to NATO membership.
Do you have a sense of what kind of impact pulling this aid will have, recognizing, like you just said, that we're not exactly sure what it covers, but do you have a sense even now of what kind of impact this is going to have?
Well, Michelle, there might not be an immediate impact. A member of the Ukrainian Parliament's Defense Committee said today that Ukraine might be able to hold on for about 6 months without U.S. aid. Ukraine's defense industry has also been growing exponentially since Russia's 2022 invasion. So some supplies can also come from Ukraine itself. For example, Ukraine has become a powerhouse manufacturer of drones, which can replace artillery to some extent on the battlefield. But Ukraine can't replace everything, like Bradley fighting vehicles or GPS-guided rockets, or crucially, Patriot air defense systems, which are key to protecting Ukrainian cities from nightly attacks by Russian drones and missiles. And also, there is the Starlink system owned by Trump ally Elon Musk. Starlink helps the military communicate.
You know, I think people might remember that Ukraine already has some experience with the U.S. holding back military aid. In 2023, Trump directed Republicans in Congress to stall a multi-billion dollar package which had been proposed by the Biden administration. Can you just remind us what happened then?
Yeah, well, holding up military aid back then certainly had a clear impact. The lack of air defense systems meant Ukrainian cities were less protected from Russian attacks, as were Ukraine's thermal power plants, which Russia repeatedly bombed and largely destroyed. And soldiers on the front line ran so low on artillery shells that they had to ration them. Some military analysts here say Russia, as a result, was able to take key cities because of weakened Ukrainian defenses.
So, Joanna, before we let you go, what are Ukraine's options?
Well, Michelle, Europe has stepped up its support, and recent research shows that the bloc could make up the difference in military aid, at least for a while. This morning, European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen also laid out a plan for the EU to boost its own defense spending by about 800 billion euros. But without the U.S., defending Ukraine and Europe will be challenging, especially in the long run.
That is NPR's Joanna Kakissis in Kyiv. Thanks, Joanna.
You're welcome, Michelle.
It's official. Linda McMahon is now U.S. Secretary of Education. The Senate voted 51-45 to confirm her last night. McMahon is best known for having led WWE, or World Wrestling Entertainment. She also headed up the Small Business Administration in the first Trump administration. And NPR's Janaki Mehta tells us her new job comes with a unique mandate.
The mandate is to put herself out of a job. That's according to President Trump, who wants to see the Department of Education gone. Now, that would require an act of Congress, something Linda McMahon acknowledged at her confirmation hearing.
We'd like to do this right. We'd like to make sure that we are presenting a plan that I think Congress could get on board with.
But the White House had already begun unwinding the agency before McMahon became its leader. The administration has made cuts to staff, to programs, and to its research wing. At her confirmation hearing, McMahon was asked about programs that send federal funding to schools. She promised to preserve some, like a program that sends money to schools in low-income communities, and to potentially move others, like shifting a program that supports students with disabilities to the Department of Health and Human Services.
It is not the president's goal to defund the programs. It is only to have it operate more efficiently.
McMahon was also questioned about her commitment to public education. Most American children go to public schools, and she's been a vocal supporter of school choice, something that isn't always an option for students in parts of the country without many schools to choose from.
I absolutely do believe that our public schools are the bedrock of our education. They go back to the very founding of our country.
A new poll by NPR PBS News and Marist finds there isn't much public support for shutting down the Department of Education. 63% of respondents opposed getting rid of it. 37% were in favor. Janaki Mehta, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
We'll be right back. on the next Fresh Air, Mardi Gras Day, we'll be joined by a Mardi Gras attraction, clarinetist and vocalist Doreen Ketchens. Known as Lady Louie, she's a fixture of the French Quarter in New Orleans. We'll talk with her about her decades-long career as a street performer, and she'll play some music. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Subaru. The 2025 Subaru Outback features standard symmetrical all-wheel drive, including safety features like EyeSight Driver Assist technology. Learn more at Subaru.com/Outback. From FJC, a foundation of donor-advised funds, working to maximize the impact of charitable giving and to create customized philanthropic solutions. Learn more at FJC.org. From Progressive Insurance, with its Name Your Price tool, a way to see coverage options based on a driver's budget. Learn more at Progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Nigerian writer Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie's first three novels won prizes and critical acclaim. Two were optioned for movies, and one, Americana, sold more than a million copies in the U.S. alone. But then, for some reason, the words stopped.
I went through what people like to call writer's block, which is an expression I do not like because I'm very superstitious.
She did write speeches and essays on feminism, human rights, and grief, even a children's book. But the novel eluded her, until now.
Writing fiction is the love of my life. It's the thing that I think gives me meaning. And it's quite different. I mean, the entire process is very different from writing nonfiction. With fiction, it's magical.
Her new novel, Dream Count, just out today, tells the interconnected stories of four women, three with ties to Nigeria, the fourth to Guinea. But even before the characters came to her, she says, there was a phrase lodged in her mind, waiting to be put to use. It became the first sentence of her book.
I have always longed to be known, truly known, by another human being. It's been floating in my head for years, and I knew I would write something with that as kind of the kernel of the story. But I really do not know how these women came. They came to me, and it's difficult for me often to talk about the choices I make in fiction in a very narrowly intellectual way, because there's so much that's intuitive.
You said you'd carried that line in your head for years. I wonder why.
I don't know. I consider myself fortunate to have been known, I think. And yet I question how well I've been known. One of the things that happened to me during COVID was that losing my father made me question how well I knew myself. And when I heard the news of my father's death, I threw myself down on the ground and I was pounding the floor. And I did not realize I was doing this. And afterwards, I was shocked by it because I think if you'd asked me how I would react to losing my father, I think I would have said that I would just go numb and completely cold. And so that made me think, my goodness, I did not realize I had this level of melodrama. You know, I sort of half joke about it now, but it did make me think about how well do I know myself? How well am I known by other people? How well do I know other people? And there's just a general longing, I think, that I've always had. I mean, and I'm very fortunate. I have a wonderful family, so it doesn't come from a lack of love, but still it's there.
Tell us about the four women around whom you organized the book, your four principal characters.
So Chiamaka is the Nigerian woman who lives in the U.S. She's a travel writer who wishes that she were a better writer than she is. And she's very privileged. She comes from a very wealthy family. Her best friend, Zikora, who lives in Washington, D.C. and is a lawyer, is quite different from her. Zikora is very practical. And Omelogo is Chiamaka's cousin, and she lives in Nigeria. She's a very successful banker. She's brilliant. And she's also very unconventional. And the fourth character, and this is the character that's most precious to me, is Kajetu, and she's from Guinea. And she is an immigrant in the U.S., and she experiences this very painful thing.
I'm trying to figure out how to talk about what happens to Kadiatou without giving it away. She's based on something that happened with this Nafissatou Diallo was a hotel worker who accused the then head of the IMF and also the presidential hopeful, Dominique Strauss-Kahn, so-called DSK. She accused him of sexual assault in 2011. She was a hotel cleaner, and she went into his room, and she said that he assaulted her. He was, in fact, arrested, but then the charges were dropped because all these things emerged about how her journey and so forth, at least in the eyes of the prosecution, made her an unreliable witness. And people forget that, obviously, you know, if you follow these things, it's a very traumatic experience. But this is before the Me Too movement. You said this character is very dear to you. Tell us why this was so dear to you and why it was so important to you to include this, I don't even want to say story. Story feels diminishing, but it's not meant to be.
Mm. Yes. When I first heard the story of this woman who had accused this very powerful man of assault, I followed it very closely. I felt connected to her for, I think, you know, obvious reasons. She's quite different from me. She's from Guinea, I'm Nigerian, she's Muslim, I'm Christian, and she's working class, I'm not. But she felt to me quite familiar and knowable, and I felt protective of her. But it wasn't until the case was dropped that I just felt something like rage. It became for me not just about her. And so this character that I've written, I've actually really invented the character. The character is not her, I mean, apart from the tiny kernel of the story of the assault.
Yes, you're very clear about that. I just want to make that very clear.
Yeah, so it's really not her. I've, you know, invented everything. But I think for me, that character is not just about Nafissatou Diallo. It's also about all the women, and there's so many women like her across the world, who, because they are powerless, are not given a certain kind of human dignity.
We've had a very serious conversation here, but I do have to say the book is very funny. I mean, it's very funny.
Yes.
But some of the... Okay, all right, I will say this. The men don't come off particularly well in this book.
That
I don't know if you feel
heart.
That way, but
that
some of them are kind of trash, at least as depicted by you in this book. Some of these men are just trash. I'm sorry.
But you know what? I wanted to write about women's lives. And the reality of it is that for many women, the men in their lives, in some ways, shape their lives. You know, generally that women are socialized to be the ones who compromise more, who hold back their dreams for people they love, that kind of thing.
And, you know, I'm going to ask, are any of these people you?
All of them are me, Michelle. All of them. Madame Bovary, c'est moi.
Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie is the author of Dream Count. It is out now. Thank you so much for joining us once again.
Thank you so much. This was wonderful. Thank you.
This is NPR News.
Warming waters off New England's coast are bringing in new fish and new opportunities for fishermen there. But climate change is happening so fast that regulators and fishermen can't keep up.
My biggest worry is losing the industry. We can't wait a decade because there won't be New England fishing industries left anymore.
That story on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. Canada and China have hit back against President Trump's long-threatened tariffs that went into effect last night. Canada says it will slap 25% tariffs on nearly $110 billion in U.S. goods. China says it will levy at least a 10% tariff on U.S. agricultural goods. NPR's Emily Fang has more.
President Trump imposed tariffs on Canada and Mexico and doubled existing tariffs on China over what he alleges is an influx of fentanyl coming into the U.S. from these three countries. China's Commerce Ministry issued a sharply worded statement in response to the tariffs, saying the U.S. was, quote, ignoring the facts, a, quote, typical unilateral and bullying act. It cited cooperation between the two countries that began during the Biden administration to catch fentanyl makers in China and said China wanted to resolve differences through dialogue as soon as possible. China also spent the last 5 years making its own economy more resilient to external economic pressures, like U.S. tariffs. Emily Fang, NPR News, Washington.
President Trump gives an address to a joint session of Congress tonight, his first since returning to the White House for his second term last month. The theme is the renewal of the American dream. Trump is expected to lay out his domestic and foreign policy agendas. Wall Street sharply lower at this hour. The Dow is down 743 points. The Nasdaq is down 289. You're listening to NPR News. The world's oldest scientific academy, the Royal Society of London, held a special meeting last night over a growing campaign to expel one of its most famous members, Elon Musk. NPR's Lauren Freyer has more from London.
Elon Musk was named a Fellow of the Royal Society back in 2018 for his scientific contributions to space travel and electric vehicle technology. But more than 3,400 scientists, including some fellow Royal Society members, have signed an open letter calling Musk a threat to science now because of his support for unprecedented cuts to scientific research in the U.S. and how he's allegedly spread misinformation online. The Society has not expelled anyone in 250 years. And after a crisis meeting, it appears to have held off on any action toward Musk, at least for now. It issued a statement expressing concern for colleagues in the U.S. and said its fellows need to stand up for science, without mentioning any names. Lauren Freyer, NPR News, London.
Target says its sales and profits fell during the crucial holiday quarter as customers held back on spending. The retailer says that will add pressure to its profits for the first part of this year, but Target did beat most estimates with a net income of $1.1 billion, and that was more than economists were expecting. On Wall Street, the Dow is down 771 points. That's down 1.7%. The Nasdaq down 1.5%. You're listening to NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Your Part-Time Controller, the nonprofit accounting specialists, providing financial management services to support stronger nonprofits who make the world a better place. Learn more at yptc.com/NPR. And from Moderna, committed to protecting people from COVID-19. The CDC recommends getting a second dose of this season's COVID-19 vaccine for those 65 and older. Doctors can advise about getting a second dose. This is NPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Fadel. When President Trump returns to Capitol Hill tonight, the political climate will be very different from the last time he spoke to a joint session of Congress. Back then, in 2020, Democrats still controlled the House, and Trump faced pushback from Congress. Tonight, though, Trump can expect a celebratory reception from Republicans. They have a slim majority in both chambers of Congress as he lays out his agenda. Joining us now to discuss the address is NPR's congressional correspondent, Claudia Grisadas. Hi, Claudia.
Good morning, Leila.
So this is Trump's second term in office. He's a more emboldened president. Tell us what you expect today versus what we saw in his speech 4 years ago.
Right. This Congress started out at a very fast start, mirroring much of what the administration has been doing. A lot has changed since his last address 5 years ago. As you mentioned, he had been impeached for the first time a few weeks earlier. Then House Speaker Nancy Pelosi punctuated the end of his remarks by tearing up his speech from the dais. And Republicans now control Washington, and their loyalty to the president has only grown as he dismantles sections of the federal government, installs aggressive policies to address illegal immigration, and some changes that are harder for some of his own members to stomach, such as new tariffs that were installed overnight and the stoppage of military aid to Ukraine.
And then, of course, there are also all these legal challenges related to some of these decisions. Now, this speech, I mean, Claudia, how consequential is it? Will it set the tone for Congress and its to-do list for the rest of the year?
It very much could. Republicans want to keep going at this very, very quick pace. As you remember, at the start of the year, they had passed the Lake and Riley Act. This gave law enforcement authorities wider power to go after those here without legal status in connection with crimes, who are connected to crimes. And the Senate has gone through a flurry of confirmations of cabinet members for the Trump administration. Now, Trump wants to put the squeeze on Republicans to move very quickly on getting a partisan bill out of Congress that would install another series of massive changes, from $4.5 trillion in tax cuts. It's an extension of a program installed during his first term, as well as a dramatic $2 trillion in cuts to federal spending that has some worried about Medicaid cuts. And before they can even get to all of that, they have to address a government shutdown deadline, which runs out next week, and they'll need bipartisan support, we're expecting, and both parties could be very far apart at the moment.
Okay, that's quite the list. Now,
yes.
You know, there are a lot, there are people who really support President Trump's policies and many who are very concerned. And Democrats have faced criticism that they're just not doing enough to push back against Trump. So what are we expecting from them tonight?
Right. We know the official response will come from Senator Alyssa Slotkin. She is from Michigan, a state that Trump won in November, clearly a part of Democrats' strategy to reach into the sections of the country that they feel they can win back. But we'll also see Democrats in the chamber who will be bringing their own messages, whether they will be wearing coordinating colors. For example, the Democratic women will be wearing pink to illustrate a protest message to the president. And they'll have guests that include fired federal workers, former veterans. So you see Democrats have struggled in the past to get on the same page. Tonight will be a test if they can get on the same page and show that protest message to the president.
NPR's Claudia Grisales, thank you for your reporting, Claudia.
Thank you.
From his first campaign for the presidency, Donald Trump has accused Mexico of essentially invading the U.S. with illegal drugs and criminals. Today at the U.S. Supreme Court, Mexico is arguing that American gun manufacturers aid and abet an illegal invasion of guns from the U.S. into Mexico. Mexico is suing Smith & Wesson and other gun makers. They claim the manufacturers turn a blind eye to hundreds of thousands of high-powered weapons made in the U.S. and illegally trafficked into the hands of Mexican cartels. And NPR Legal Affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg reports.
25 years ago, gun manufacturers found themselves facing lawsuits from cities, states, and counties over gun violence. The manufacturers raced to Congress for protection, and Congress obliged with a law giving them broad immunity from liability. But there was an exception in the law. For instance, the parents of children killed in Newtown, Connecticut, won $73 million from the maker of the Bushmaster rifle used in the massacre. The families argued that the company's marketing tactics targeted vulnerable young men and encouraged illegal behavior. Lawyer Jonathan Lowy is co-counsel for Mexico in today's case and president of Global Action on Gun Violence. He maintains that while 90% of gun dealers act legally, the rest do not.
Those bad actors sell to obvious cartel traffickers in bulk sales and repeated sales, where traffickers come into the store repeatedly over weeks and months, buying large amounts of AK-47s, AR-15s, sniper rifles that can shoot down helicopters, often paying in cash. Manufacturers know who those dealers are, how they're supplying the cartels, and yet they continue to choose to sell their guns through those dealers and allowing those sales practices.
That's a flawed argument, counters Lawrence Kane, counsel for the National Shooting Sports Foundation, the trade association for the firearms industry.
Every sale to a consumer by a licensed retailer is approved by the federal government. Every transaction requires a federally mandated background check. In Mexico, they're arguing that your lawful distribution system that's approved under federal law is aiding and abetting the cartels. If that was all that was required, Budweiser would be responsible for drunk driving accidents all across the United States and apparently including in Mexico.
Mexico notes that it is a country where guns are supposed to be difficult to get. There's just one store in the whole country where guns can be bought legally, yet the nation is awash in illegal guns, sold most often to the cartels. Mexico maintains that this gushing pipeline of what it calls crime guns comes from the United States, where manufacturers know which dealers are the bad actors. Again, Jonathan Lowy, co-counsel for Mexico.
You can't hide behind middlemen and act like you don't know what's happening.
Lawrence Kane of the Gun Manufacturers Trade Association has a very different view.
This case by Mexico is an attempt to have regulation through litigation. And it's particularly offensive, candidly, when it is done by a foreign sovereign who comes into a U.S. court and then seeks not just $10 billion in damages, but injunctive relief to regulate how product can be sold and to whom. That's an invasion of U.S. sovereignty.
A decision in the case is expected by summer. Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.
This is NPR News. A new book tells the story of film star Merle Oberon. She hid her South Asian background to pass as a white woman in 1930s Hollywood. That's next time on Here and Now.
Our phones hold a lot of stuff, right? Grocery lists, music, pet photos. They also help us stay informed. Listen live on this station's website or NPR.org.
Good morning, I'm Leila Faldin. It's official, time is money. A man in Bangalore won about $300 last month after a theater played two PSAs and 17 commercials before his movie. Annoying? Maybe, but worth a lawsuit? Well, the ads tacked on nearly a half hour to the movie's scheduled finish, forcing him to cancel work calls. A court ruling in his favor said, quote, "People with tight schedules do not have time to waste." It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the Charles Stewart Mott Foundation, for nearly a century supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable, and sustainable society. More at mott.org. From the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, supporting books, radio, podcasts, film, television, theater, and more to bridge science and the humanities. And from Eric and Wendy Schmidt, through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Faldin. Good morning. Fishermen are concerned about the sudden layoffs at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration and the National Weather Service. As Molly Enking with Maine Public Radio reports, that's because they need weather reports to stay safe in a dangerous business.
Over 2,000 people from across New England convened at the annual Maine Fishermen's Forum over the weekend to talk all things fish. But this year, between gear expos, panels, and buddies catching up, there was an undercurrent of uncertainty after news broke of hundreds of NOAA layoffs in both weather and fish management divisions. At a panel on federal fish management efforts, one NOAA speaker was absent, and the other declined to answer questions about how changes at the federal agency might impact local fishing. Eric Hess fishes for tuna far off the coast of Cape Cod.
We're worried about the impact of it. We engaged with NOAA on, you know, various levels, whether it's reporting, observer coverage. So all these things are part of our daily life on the water, and to suddenly lose part of that could really disrupt our fisheries.
NOAA is the U.S.'s main weather forecaster, constantly monitoring the seas and the skies. The Coast Guard relies on National Weather Service reports for in-the-moment updates on hurricanes or high winds, sent out to boats via radio. Devin Campbell is a 24-year-old fisherman out of Boothbay Harbor, Maine.
Yeah, we tow a big net and steel doors around and try to come home with a few fish.
He says he compulsively checks his weather apps throughout the day, scrolling them more often than social media.
Your life is so dependent on it that it's just something you have to always look at. It's a constant.
National Weather Service data feed practically every weather app mariners use. Accurate data, including wind and wave height, is essential to fishermen's safety and their bottom line, says fisherman Jim Buxton, especially for those out in deep waters.
Steaming for 3 hours in the dark to get there to haul their first string at daylight, say 6 o'clock in the morning. And if the tide changes, the conditions get terrible, they have to steam back for 3 hours and make no money. This is for real.
Andy Hazelton was a scientist at the National Weather Service's Hurricane Research Division before he was laid off last week. He says the department was already understaffed before he and a dozen of his colleagues were let go.
I think it's going to make things more dangerous. It risks reversing the progress we've made because we've seen huge improvements in hurricane forecasts and things like that over the last 30 years, and it risks reversing that and making the public, you know, less safe as a result.
Jim Buxton says fishermen like him need weather and ocean data to get more accurate, not less.
When they forecast a bad weather day and it doesn't happen and you choose not to go, that has a real economic cost. And when they forecast a good day and that doesn't happen, there's not only an economic cost, but there's actually a human risk where people are out in conditions that they don't expect and they potentially could get hurt.
Andy Hazelton says his colleagues who are still working at National Weather Service are busy sorting through all the projects he and others left behind. Hazelton is still hoping his job might be reinstated once officials realize NOAA's vital work in keeping the public safe. For NPR News, I'm Molly Enking in Portland, Maine.
This is NPR News. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Clearing land for dairy cows and cattle is the biggest driver of deforestation worldwide, and that is a major contributor to climate change. Some farmers in Colombia have a solution. NPR's Julia Simon went to visit.
A herd of brown cows moves under trees, drooping with moss and vines.
They look humongous. They look really big.
These cows belong to Carlos Hernando Molina and his family. They've owned the El Atico farm in southwest Colombia since the 1700s. In the past few decades, they've turned it into
el mejor hotel para una vaca.
The best hotel for a cow, Molina says. It's a hotel that has controlled temperatures, good quality food, and the cows sleep placidly. The controlled temperatures, he mentions, come from the trees. Most South American cows live under the hot sun, but at El Atico, the trees provide shade.
It's so much cooler under the tree.
And the seed pods and leaves from the trees give cows nutrition. This hotel for cows is something called silvopastoralism. That's the integration of trees, grasses, and livestock. And according to some scientists, it can be an important solution to address global warming.
Bueno, salud.
Salud.
Solo un poco.
Over Colombian coffee on their terrace, Molina and his family tell me how they created this hotel for cows. It started in 1993 when the Molinas visited a farmer who was doing silvopasture. When they saw the splendid scene of cows amongst the trees.
Esplendoroso. Entonces nosotros dijimos, uy, ¿cómo será esto en el Atico? ¿Cómo será?
They asked, how do we do this in El Atico?
Ese mismo día. Cosechamos las semillas.
They got the seeds that day and started planting trees. Now they don't use fertilizers made with fossil fuels. They use less irrigation. The cows make more milk. And
2.4 vacas por hectárea antes. Ahora 4.5.
The Molinas have almost twice as many cows per hectare. This is a big reason some researchers see silvopasture as a climate solution.
Beef production or dairy production, simply that uses a lot of land.
This is Tim Searchinger, agriculture and climate expert at Princeton University.
The silvopasture people have shown that there are ways to do silvopastoral systems that increase productivity severalfold.
The Colombian government has been promoting these practices, but while silvopasture may have big climate benefits in the tropics, it may have less of a climate benefit in places where farms are already very efficient. Here's Jessica Zients. She's a land use researcher at Oxford University.
Being aware of the context is important. Not letting that fun, feel-good thing of happy cows playing in the trees, don't let that get in the way of pursuing other solutions.
Other solutions, she says, like eating less beef and dairy, will still be key to reducing the climate impact of cows, even if silvopasture can improve the efficiency of raising cows.
We have to bring consumption down and improve efficiency. Both of those things have to happen.
Back at El Atico, we hear another benefit of the system. There are 145 species of birds, like yellow-headed caracaras and a white heron standing right in front of a cow's face.
Oh my God, they're looking at each other like they're in love.
El Atico is a hotel for cows and biodiversity. And the Molinas are always welcoming visitors from across Latin America. Molina says they come to learn about silvopasture and take the lessons home. Julia Simon, NPR News, Colombia.
The filmmakers behind a wordless movie about animals trying to survive a flood, Flo, now hold this year's Oscar for Best Animated Feature. But for parents thinking of quickly adding Flo to their screen time rotation, NPR's Elizabeth Blair reports the movie has proven too scary for some little kids.
Flo has everything a kid might want. A courageous cat, a yellow lab, a capybara, funny lemurs.
I was like, oh, this looks like something I will watch with my kids.
Philip Sledge, a content producer for the entertainment site CinemaBlend, says he did, and it was a mistake. He says they have a cat that looks just like the one in the movie. When the waters started to rise, his 11-year-old started to cry.
She was scared. She was worried about all the animals.
Other families had similar reactions. One commenter on the website Common Sense Media wrote that she had to stop the movie because her 9 and 10-year-old daughters were sobbing. Flo is definitely not one of those cute movies about lovable talking animals. There are signs of human life, but we never see or hear any people. Betsy Bozdek, Common Sense Media's editorial director, thinks Flo is like a great picture book that doesn't have words.
These animals are definitely in peril, but they also find a whole lot of companionship and camaraderie.
Common Sense Media recommends Flo for ages 6 and up. Bozdek says to come up with its age rating criteria, they work with child development experts.
When you look at what levels of tension and scariness are appropriate for which ages, it kind of fell in line at around age 6 plus.
But Bozdek says all families are different, and what works for some kids won't work for others. She says a movie like Flo can help kids experience some uncomfortable emotions in a safe environment.
Part of parents' jobs is to raise kids who are resilient and able to handle all the things that life throws at them, not just the good stuff.
Bozdek recommends parents watch Flo with their kids so they can talk about the scary parts. Meantime, Philip Sledge says he watched the Oscars with his daughter. Even though she had cried during Flo, she got excited when it was mentioned.
She was like, oh, I remember that movie. I love Flo so much. Let's watch it again.
Elizabeth Blair, NPR News.
I mean, these animated movies end up tackling some pretty heavy things sometimes. Michelle, any movies that haunted you as a kid?
Oh, I don't know, all of them? Like, I'm sorry. Your girl does not do scary. What about you?
Do you remember the Chucky movies with the killer doll movies? I can play the Cabbage Patch Kids ever again if you remember those.
Because, as I said, I don't do scary, so I've read about it, but...
That Chucky's back.
Why are you trying to haunt me for the rest of the day? No.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm Michelle Martin.